WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot has changed in the Colombian cocaine market. The days of Pablo Escobar and the Medellin cartel are over, but others have taken their place. The U.S. market for cocaine has leveled off, but the European market has expanded. One of the things that has stayed the same is that it is very dangerous for the press in Colombia to report on the drug lords. It's also dangerous to report on the left and right-wing paramilitary groups which are funded by drug money. My guest Enrique Santos Calderon is editor-in-chief of the daily El Tiempo. He and his reporters have been threatened with death by drug lords. 34 journalists have been killed in Colombia in the past 10 years. Calderon took over as editor-in-chief of El Tiempo last year after the former editor, his cousin Francisco Santos, fled the country because of a death threat. 10 years earlier, Santos was kidnapped by Escobar's henchmen and held hostage for 8 months. I asked Enrique Santos Calderon if he's afraid to remain a journalist in Colombia.
To cope with fear is one of the things that one has to learn when one is a journalist in Colombia. And there's a saying that every person is the owner of his own fear, the administrator of his own fear. And so one learns to cope with that, to live with it, every person in his own way. I've been threatened a lot. I've had to leave the country on 2 occasions.
Your home was bombed, wasn't it?
My home was bombed on one occasion. Since 10 years, I go around in an armored car with bodyguards. It's a very stressful situation. It's a terrible situation, but one says that the man is a creature of habit, and in a way you sort of get used to it, and you learn to cope with it, you learn to disregard certain kinds of threats. You learn all kinds of security measures, different routes, different schedules. In a way, one adapts, but what fear is always there.
Can you give us an example of a story that you had to anguish about before deciding whether to publish it or not, because you knew that it would put journalists at your paper at risk?
Well, usually what we learned very rapidly is that all the people, the journalists, reporters, or investigators that we assigned to cover drug stories were no bylines. Nobody signed any kind of list of stories. After the editor-in-chief and part owner of Colombia's oldest daily paper, El Espectador, the second national newspaper after El Tiempo, he was assassinated by orders of Pablo Escobar in the mid-80s. Then, for the first time, the Colombian press did a thing that has no precedent in the history of Latin American journalism. I don't think in the world this ever happened. That all the papers, the big papers, small papers, magazines, TV news programs, radio programs, got together and decided that we would not compete anymore on these kind of stories. That we would pool our resources to investigate the drug cartels, to investigate where they were, how they infiltrated all the aspects of society, and we would publish exactly the same story, exactly the same day, with the same layout, with the news programs, the TV news programs would publish the same kind of news program, and the radio also. So it was an incredible reaction of self-defense, and also of going out and attacking them while defending ourselves through all this kind of collective, anonymous work, so that they couldn't individualize us. They couldn't single out any paper or any journalist. They had to kill us all or nobody. And in a way, it worked, because they were very disconcerted. They were flabbergasted. They didn't know how to react. And it was a very emotional and a very beautiful experience of how we can protect ourselves and stop certain kind of competition and individual things when our life in our newspapers and our professions are at stake.
So did you do that once, or is that a pattern? Do you always do that on the drug stories now?
We did it like for 3 months, almost every week. Until, of course, I mean, journalists is by nature so competitive, and that this couldn't last very much, because, I mean, we're not made out to do to work in this fashion. But it served its purpose in the sense that it was a message to the country. It was a message to the drug cartels that we would not be intimidated, that we had means of responding. And then we all went back to doing our things, each in its own way, in our newspapers and in our TV programs. But it was a very, very positive and very interesting experience.
What kinds of deals do the drug lords or do the armed groups try to offer you to not publish something?
No, usually it's the philosophy of what we call in Spanish plomo o plata, no? Money or lead, no? Intimidation or corruption. And these guys could... What they couldn't do, because most of the media down there is family owned, no, it's not public stock. They couldn't buy their way in, which they did with other industries and other aspects of the economy. And so that's when they resorted to just to the kidnapping or to assassinations or to dynamite attacks and things like that. But what the armed groups now try to do is they try to offer exclusive interviews with their chiefs. And anyway, since we have a peace process going on, the Colombian government is talking with the guerrilla groups, and so that has given them a certain legitimacy. And if the government talks to them, and there's a peace process going on, then they're interviewable, and they try to combine the giving interviews and exclusive visits to their jungle camps and all that. But then, if they don't like what comes out, there might be a problem. And so they mix the intimidation with the offering of interviews and of special things.
So when you're offered an interview or a visit to their camp, will you accept it, knowing that if you publish something they don't like, then there'll be threats and violence?
No, so we accept it, and different papers react in different ways. But as a whole, the Colombian media has been very firm in saying that, I mean, how to do these interviews? No, they have to be very spontaneous interviews. They cannot be censored, or they cannot be. The rules of the game cannot be set by the guerrilla chiefs or by the paramilitary chiefs. There's always a struggle here, a give and take in these things. But I would say that the journalism in Colombia has managed to impose on them certain rules of, if they're going to be interviewed, they have to accept our rules and not theirs. And slowly, in a way, I think they're learning.
What are some of the most important stories that your newspaper has broken?
Oh, boy. Put me thinking now. I think one of the most satisfying experiences has been to save a life. That was when... a missionary of Norwegian origin that that worked in the Colombian jungle near the frontier with Venezuela with the Catatumbo Indians, with the Motilón Indians. A missionary that worked for many years in this region. And he was kidnapped by one of the smaller guerrilla groups, the National Liberation Army, ELN, and was accused of being a sort of a CIA foreign agent that was indoctrinating the Indian tribes with imperialist literature and all kinds of things. And he was sentenced to death. He was tried in one of these mock revolutionary courts and sentenced to death. And I had known him for many years, called Bruce Olson. And so I was Sunday editor at that time, and I decided to launch sort of a national campaign in my Sunday edition to save this missionary's life, and an appeal to all the Indian tribes in Colombia and to all the anthropology groups and all the sociologists that this was the most unjust and arbitrary thing. And this campaign had such a success, it spread like wildfire, and all the Indian groups started, you know, demonstrating and sending messages to the ELN, and it became so intense that this group did a thing that it had never done before, which is because it always, all its death sentence, they always carried them out, had to admit and recognize that had been mistaken, and that the spontaneous popular reaction in favor of Bruce Olson convinced him that he was no imperialist agent, and they set him free. And that was, for me, that was one of the most exciting things in my career. And when Bruce came to the paper and with all his Indian chief friends to say his thanks.
The newspaper that you edit, El Tiempo, has been run by your family since 1913. Are there similar stories from other generations of your family about having to publish the newspaper under the constant threat of violence and retribution?
Yes, and unfortunately, Colombia has a long tradition of political violence. And in the 1940s and 1950s, when the two main political parties in Colombia, the liberals and the conservatives, were practically in a sort of a non-declared civil war, and the conservatives were in power, and El Tiempo was in the opposition. Well, El Tiempo was burned down by hordes of the conservative party that were sent by the government. It was burned down, and later, under the military dictatorship in the 1950s, it was closed down for a couple of years. So, I mean, our family and my father and my grandfather, they've also had to cope with the very difficult moments of tension and of threats and of violence.
My guest is Enrique Santos Calderon, the editor-in-chief of the Colombian newspaper El Tiempo. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Enrique Santos Calderon, is the editor-in-chief of the Colombian newspaper El Tiempo. We're talking about the difficulty of covering drug lords because of their death threats against journalists who investigate them. How did the armed groups on the left and the right become aligned with the drug syndicates?
The guerrillas sprung up in the 1960s and the influence of the Cuban Revolution and due to problems of poverty, of regions of Colombia where the government didn't function or didn't exist. A lot of misery, peasants that were in very difficult conditions. So there were social and economic conditions for the springing up of these groups. But then, as the drug phenomena started in the 70s, in the marijuana at the beginning, and then the cocaine, and then the heroin, and all the consumption in the United States, and these groups that were already there, that had their own areas of influence, of power, where nobody went in, they had their own small private armies, they realized that this was a source of income that was incredible. You have to understand that drugs have no ideology, so the drug economy moves on the left, moves on the right, and the south of the country, where all the coca plantations are, and they're controlled by the guerrilla movements, it has a leftist face. In the north of the country, in all the cattle lands, where the paramilitary groups move, and they're also financed by narcos, it has a rightist face. So you might call them leftist and rightist, but I think that all these armed groups have lost most of their ideological values and are now just, it's a way of living and a way of intimidating, of having power over certain parts of the country. They have the armed power, and they have the economic power, and they've lost all their political credibility in my way of seeing it.
I'm wondering if any of the armed leaders on either side, on the right or the left, have become drug addicts as a result of becoming so dependent on the drug economy?
As a general rule, no. They tend to be very strict in that. For example, on the guerrilla part and on the para part, drug consumption is totally forbidden. I mean, it's punishable by death. People are shot when drug trafficking is completely outlawed in their zones of influence and control. They see it sort of more as a business. They're really businessmen in that sense, but they don't tolerate or promote or accept drug consumption within their own ranks. I mean, the phenomena have occurred, but I mean, as an exception to the rule.
Colombia has been called the kidnapped capital of the world, and you know, often journalists are kidnapped. Other people throughout Colombia are kidnapped. I think you said there's one kidnapping every 4 hours. What's the point of that? Is it for ransom money? Is it to make a point and to terrorize the population? All of the above.
It's No, it's totally ransom. It's totally economic. It's become an industry. Kidnapping is an industry down there. And you have all kinds of all levels of kidnapping. The big multimillionaire kidnappings, the kidnappings of a middle class, of lower class kidnappings in those poor neighborhoods. The guerrilla has lately resorted to the most incredible thing, which is called there the, I don't know how to translate, La Pesca Milagrosa. It's like on the road they will stop on a highway or any national road, all the cars that they see that more or less of a good model, they will stop. They have them. They have laptop computers, and then the people identify themselves, and if they more or less have a bank account or something, there's been massive kidnappings of 40, 50, 60 persons in 2 hours in a highway, for example. They've even resorted to kidnapping people in buses. You know? So it's degenerated into really a very massive phenomenon, which is tearing our country apart. I mean, when you realize that six to seven people are kidnapped every day, that more than half of the kidnappings in the world are take place in Colombia, then. And you can more or less imagine what this has come to.
Last year, the U.S. Congress authorized $1.3 billion for the region's war against drugs. What's your impression about how that money is being used or is going to be used in Colombia?
Well, it's a big debate, big controversy on this. It's called the Plan Colombia, this massive aid program for Colombia, which has a very strong emphasis on the military aspect and on the aerial eradication of the spraying of the coca fields. My personal view is that we need military aid in the sense that the Colombian state has not only the right but the obligation to defend itself against all these private armies that are practically overwhelming the institutions. The armies on the right of the paramilitaries and of the left of the guerrillas, they are very well armed. They have no scruples of any kind. They are financed by the drug money, by the kidnappings. They respect absolutely no human right. And the Colombian government has to modernize and professionalize its armed forces. It needs help. It needs technical equipment. It needs more helicopter. It needs surveillances. So it's... If democracy is going to prevail in Colombia, we need this kind of aid. Nevertheless, what I see, what worries me is all this emphasis on anti-drug thing of this aid. Like, it's the old obsession of the United States with Colombia. They see it all through this prism of war on drugs. And if they start all this spraying of the coca fields and you don't offer all these peasants an alternative to live, then all you're going to do is push them into the arms of the paramilitaries or the guerrilla, because if eradication is not accompanied by crop substitution, by alternative development, if it just means that you're taking the livelihood and the way of living of the peasants and not giving nothing in return, then this will be counterproductive in the sense that it'll only make the guerrillas and the paras stronger.
The United States is giving a considerable amount of money to help eradicate coca crops. I'm wondering if you think that the United States is part of the problem because it's such a big market for the cocaine and heroin that is being exported.
I would say it is the problem. I mean, this is the old discussion, the hen or the egg, supplier demand, but it's evident that what sustains other thing is the consumption and the demand for these products. And if you eradicate them tomorrow, let's say from Colombia, the Plan Colombia works miraculously. Coca cultivation is eradicated from Colombian territory. The next day it will spring up in Bolivia or in Ecuador, in Peru or in Venezuela, in Brazil, as long as you have a demand. In that sense, the war on drugs is a war without end, and it's a war that has and no solution in the way it's being carried out now.
You have a lot of security protecting you. You have guards. You have an armored car. Mm-hmm. Does any of that ever get in the way of practicing journalism?
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. I haven't thought of it that way. I mean, I think of it as a safety measure. But the type of journalism I practice now, which is basically writing editorials and editing certain kind of opinion pieces, it doesn't get much in the way. And of course, excessive security is very repressive of intimacy, of private life, of even of, you feel like a little bit caged in sometimes, and that might hamper you mentally sometimes too. But I haven't, these safety measures, I haven't felt that have limited myself. When I go out, for example, when I go out to interview or to talk with the guerrilla leaders, like 2 months ago I was talking with the chiefs of the ELN, I usually go on my own, and we make promises, these guys, that they will, if I go and they know I'm going, then the security runs on their account. So there's all kinds of arrangements that you have to do with security in Colombia.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, it's all right.
Enrique Santos Calderon is the editor-in-chief of the Colombian newspaper El Tiempo. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.